Dr. Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
episode 21 of Chasing the Sun by Richard Cohen, where I'm just podcasting away, getting rehab, being able to read for perhaps more and more hours a day. It's titled The Epic Story of the Star That Gives Us Life, and I think this person is, I thought, walking Wikipedia, and I think he's Wikipedia supported at least a little bit in what he writes. Now, we start off with Mapping the Deep by Robert Kunzig. The ocean looks like a fairly homogeneous place. It's all water after all, yet that seawater, like the seafloor, only seems to be homogeneous. James Hamilton Patterson. Why did Dr. Ballard, on his journeys to photograph the Titanic, habitually play classical music during the descent and rock music on the way up? It's unthinkable that it could have been any other way around. Okay, well, I don't know what that exactly means. And this title is chapter 18. So we took two chapters at the start before we got going. Prologue and a sort of floating chapter, and then one of the chapters is just too long and broke it into two, so that's why we're three behind. Now, according to the legend, Alexander the Great had himself lowered into the Mediterranean in a glass cage whose door was fastened with chains, and during his vigil observed fish so large that it took 3 days and three nights for them to swim past. He's said to have recorded, "None of the men who have ever been here before me, and none of those who shall come after me, shall see the mountains and the sea and the darkness and the light that I have seen." Well, I'm sure that's very much a legend, isn't it? Given that we know that the state of Greek glass blowing and all that type of stuff. Darkness covers many unknown worlds. Even now, 95% of our oceans remain unexplored. And oceanographers are fond of pointing out that there is more known about the moon's surface, winds, surface than the seafloor. We do know throughout the great seabeds, wind once a series of volcanic gashes, about 60,000 kilometres of carbon dioxide spewing mountain ranges pierced. Oh, I don't know, it's intensely carbon dioxide. Pierced by immense scalding springs. The oceanographer Bruce Henson has named it the wound that never heals. Though, through the fissures surge great quantities of water, the temperature's at 550 degrees Fahrenheit, almost four times boiling point at this pressure. But here, the pressure is prevented from passing into steam by the downweight miles of ocean above it, laden with inorganic chemicals of all kinds, sulfates, nitrates, phosphates, along with compounds of hydrogen oxide, carbon dioxide, methane gas. The water smothers the seabed with untold amounts of insoluble salts that can never rise to the surface. The one exception to this comes through an event known as the Black Smokers. Furious chemical reactors so hot that they leach copper, iron and zinc out of the earth's crust and erupt them above the surface to form columns of rock belching what looks like and they have this got to do with the sun, but let's read it on ahead. Black smoke. I'm really doubting all the gases, but how, you know, I really do have a great doubt about precisely doing the gases to the light on. The largest it's found, Godzilla, off the coast of Washington State, is more than 16 stories tall, asterisk. One piece of subterranean research is worth mentioning. On January 16th, 2006, the Chiku, Japan's Apollo mission, set off to drill 3 miles below the seabed, more than three times deeper than ever before, 2.5 miles off the coast of Nagoya and west-southwest of Tokyo. What it ridges up may show whether the energy that originated the first semblance of life on the Earth was geothermal rather than solar. It may also help to understand why the Earth's magnetic poles repeatedly switch. This is complete rubbish. He's written that off some sort of website. I do know that because I think 56, they began to see the poles reversal, and about 20 years later, and my father was involved in doing that statistical analysis, where the reversal was predictable at all. Of course not. It's a bit weird. Some bacteria manage to exist in these immensely hot places, using iron as a means of respiration. This is where we employ oxygen, metabolizing it into black magnetic minerals called magnetite. Is that bacteria? That's pretty amazing. That blows my mind. I thought bacteria weren't here. It was archaea, different species altogether. More than 100 different species dependent on bacteria have been discovered around the vents. I think he means archaea, not bacteria. I can't imagine bacteria surviving. Not only microbes, but holothurians, sea cucumbers. 8-foot longs, Luke worms that glow and grow into thick clumps with blood red heads like rosebud, shrimps and clams, each which can be as much as a foot across, reef of six inch mussels, scrabbling porcelain white crabs, all using the energy derived not just from the oxidation of ferrous iron salts, but also from sulfur, hydrogen sulfide, and molecular oxygen. The iron devouring bacteria feed the clams and shrimps. Now, I could well imagine that. So they eat iron salts and put out magnetite. It's an amazing story. Wouldn't that be fantastic? Hydrogen sulfide and molecular hydrogen. The iron devouring bacteria feed the clams and shrimps, which are in turn eaten by crabs and by the sinister-looking 5-foot-wide, whitish-grey, hooded octopus. Nearly all these beasts were new to science and cannot live anywhere else. This part of the world has been named the Dark Biosphere. What has all this got to do with the sun? I have to ask that myself. Question. These creatures and habitats are unique, constituting the only ecosystem on Earth that derives its energy from chemosynthesis and exists not on the trickle-down of sunlight, but on the upblast of geochemistry. Beautifully put. Isn't it beautiful? Even if you may be getting all of this from Wikipedia, he has got a turn of phrase. Look at him. He knows how to put just the positives to things. Yet even here, photosynthesis plays a role, as the vast bulk of oxidants used by these creatures comes from the light-driven ecosystems of the ocean surface. Even the sulfur-eating bacteria can live only in places where they also have access to oxygen, because they need it to oxidize hydrogen sulfide, stealing its electrons for latent energy. If the sun were to disappear, most of these deep-sea communities would no longer outlast would not long outlast the higher up, although a small number, bizarrely, will continue to exist, sustained by the life of the hot lava and the vents themselves. So the sun indirectly provides life even here. Good point. And we're looking at hot vents in Saturnian moons. That just makes sense. The creatures photosynthesizing on the surface can extract hydrogen from the water. Are blue-green algae, cynophytes, or blue growers, often found wherever there is constant moisture. The arrival of blue-greens marked the point of no return for the history of life, writes David Attenborough. The oxygen they produce accumulated over millennia to form a kind of oxygen-rich atmosphere we know today. These photosynthesizing organisms, made up of single cells called phytoplankton, Greek for wandering plants, also, plankton means phyto. Phyto means, wandering. Which measure at most a few thousandths of an inch across, are confined to a thin layer near the ocean surface. For light is quickly absorbed, and below 700 feet, normal photosynthesis is impossible. The greatest depth at which conventional plant life has been found is 710 feet off the Bahamas, where a clump of maroon algae prospers in exceptionally transparent water. But the fin layer is rich with photosynthesizing agents, and all animal life in the sea, from jellyfish to whales, and even denizens of the seafloor hot springs, depend on these cells. With the end of winter, chlorophyll The molecule that plants use to absorb sunlight turns the entire North Atlantic green. Wow. How does that happen? No one can number the many species of phytoplanktons, but these seaborne plants, along with this land-dwelling forest, draw out of the atmosphere half the carbon dioxide that we put out and make life possible, not just on land, but at the greatest depth. And the with the end of winter, wow, so I suppose the Antarctic is it's just green algae. The oceans can be divided into two major realms, the shallower seas that fringe the continents and the deeper oceanic water. The former continental shelf areas are like submerged shoulders of land masses. It is here that the vast majority of marine fish live, at depths of 300 to 600 feet. If the shelf suddenly gives way to great slopes that descend to what we call the abyssal floor, cut by a V-shaped formation that, if exposed to terrestrial eyes, would rival the Grand Canyon. Again, beautiful English. Isn't he just so eloquent with his things? If exposed to less real terrestrial eyes, would rival the Grand Canyon. Economical, precise, beautiful. Huge trenches have been formed, in some places plunging nearly 7 miles down and throwing up the mid-Atlantic oceanic ridge. Foremost of all, the mountain ranges on Earth, which stretches unbroken chain from the Arctic to the Atlantic into the Antarctic, Indian Pacific Oceans, a distance of 40,000 miles. i.e. the entire girdle of the Earth. The greatest depths to be sounded so far in 1962 at the Minamanda Trench of the Philippines, where the seafloor is 37,780 feet down, a gash that could drown Mount Everest with almost a mile and a half to spare, and about 86% of the world's oceanic water lies below 300 feet. There you go. That is saying something, because that's including that 80% also includes that thing above it. In terms of it's interesting how that counts. One recalls that the Latin word atus translates to both high and deep. It lingers in the phrase the high seas. In 1951, the naturalist Charles Rachel Carson, 11 years later to publish her celebrated study of environmental dangers, Silent Spring, wrote, "The sea around us. Down beyond the reach of the sun rays," she begins poetically, if not with total accuracy, "there is no alteration of light and darkness. There is rather endless night, the old as the sea itself." If we subtract the shadow areas of the continental shelves and the scattered banks and shoals where at least pale ghosts of sunlight moves over the underlying bottom, there still remains about half the Earth which is covered by mile deep, lightless water that has been dark since the world began. Well, I don't think this really talks to continental, the seafloor spreading. Light is filtered out layer by layer, wavelength by wavelength, as it penetrates downwards, beginning with the ultraviolet and infrared. We're absorbed in the upmost 3 feet. In the night sky, the lights of an aircraft are visible many miles away, even when overhead the same lights underwater fail to reach beyond 600 feet. Below 300, the bottom is euphoric, or well-lit zone. Wavelengths are completely absorbed, and with them, orange and yellow warmth of the sun. By 500, only around 1% of the sunlight remains. Then the green goes too, although in the clearest water, blue-green illumination is still detectable at nearly 3,000 feet. By 1,000 feet, down, there is only a very dark blue. Hamilton Patterson in a diving bell that eventually descended 4,978 feet recorded at 700. Surprised there's any lights outside, but there is. The sea's intense violet colour is strangely piercing. It's a quality of light I've never quite seen before. It doesn't exist on Earth's surface and perhaps can't even be produced artificially. As sunlight falls away, a myriad of new creatures fill the darkness, inhabiting zones known reciprocally as twilight, sunless, and bottom living. In 1880, Sir John Ross, exploring the Arctic seas, brought up from 60,000 feet a mud embedded with worms, thus proving there's animal life at the bed of the ocean. In 1860, the survey ship Bullfrog found evidence of life far beyond the sun's assumed reach. Shrimp, Latin fish, squid, and arrow worms. Carson Cart's remarkable voyage of HMS Challenger, the first vessel equipped for oceanographic exploration, set out from England in 1872, although she is not specifically about the details. In 2006, the New York writer David Grann, on a hunt for giant fish, squid, retraced the Challenger's voyage. The ship had roamed the globe for 3.5 years, drifting the ocean floor and zigzagging stroll covering 38,930 miles at the rate of 2 knots or equivalent of a slow walk. The work was repetitive and brutal. Two men went insane, another killed himself. Wow, that's beautiful, isn't it? But at the journey's end, the explorer had landed 13,000 different kinds of animals and plants. It looked for the next 19 years the process of disputing, which included 4,700 new animals, 2,000 of them living below 820 feet. About the tenth, or even now known of all species of fish. It was evident that between the waves and the floors of the deep basins were throngs of large, perhaps almost remarkable biological. Yes. Pardon? I don't know. Okay. A diversity rivaling the tropical rainforests.
Back again after a break. It will sound continuous for you on the dark biosphere. Now, it's interesting for me in that I had a break and I can clearly remember a sequence of events in terms of that my focus really went into getting this package from Thailand, which you would have heard someone calling, oh, there's a package from Thailand, and get in, open it up, solid state relay, take it apart, and sort of different parts of my memory are coming back, and my soldering ability, my skills are slowly coming back mysteriously. I sort of don't quite know how. So I do things, and you know, the actual sequence of wire stripping becomes much more natural, and soldering and putting it all together and problem solving really focused on me. And then the evening I went in and did a podcast on what I'd learnt about solid state relays, which was I really needed to revert to something else I'd done early. So I don't know my sort of ability to learn things new, and came back and put the second podcast after this on the internet. I looked at, what is this podcast? I've got no actual memory of previously podcasting. Listened to it, and then it twigged and cleared, and then I read back, and then slowly the memory came back. So like the memories are there, it's just the ability to access them back. And so when I read back, I said, oh, I'm going to have to get to my point again, and the previous chapter was about photosynthesis, and this is about the sun not getting to places. And so I'll read from here. So it's you can see this is very good cognitive therapy in terms of not just reading but recalling back, you know, getting the brain
going backwards from it. So I do remember this about the a ship they're going to. So it's Sir John Ross in 1818. Sorry, this is in 1818 brought up something, and then 1860 a ship called the Bullfrog. A shrimp, lanternfish, recounts the voyage of the HMS. So the surface ship Bullfrog in 1860, HMS Challenger in 1872, 12 years. Carlson, who's apparently a female writer, writes that the details. I'm just going to really read above it. I do remember people going mad and killing themselves, but okay. So in 2006, the New Yorker Time writer Dave Grant, on a hunt for a giant squid, retraced the Challenger's voyage. So the voyage went in 1872, and he did it in 2006. The ship roamed the globe for 3.5 years, dredging the ocean floor in a zigzagging stroll covering 68,930 miles at a rate of 2 knots, equivalent of a slow walk. The work was repetitive and brutal. 2 men went insane, another killed himself. By the journey's end, the explorers had landed 13,000 different kinds of animals and plants. It took the next 19 years to process this booty, which included 4,700 new animals, 2,000 of them living below 820 feet, underneath about a tenth of what is even now known of the species of fish. It was evident that between the waves and the floor of the deep ocean basins, there was a throng with the largest, perhaps most remarkable, biological communities anywhere, diversity rivaling that of the tropical rainforest. There's an asterisk. In November 2009, scientists reported that the number of species known to be living beneath the ocean waves was now 17,650. Some 5,722 species live deeper than the black abyss of 3,280 feet. So, you know, a kilometre down is the best, the great abyss. Or it's more than, including the whalebone eater, the see-through cucumber, the wildcat tube worm, the jumbo dumbo, a specimen of octopod, and the yeti crab, which lives in hypothermal vents at roughly 7,200 feet down. I think it is pretty broad. I do know people in the survey looking for. I think there's this fish called orange ruffy that the Chinese and Taiwanese have been, you know, going down to Australian seamounts thing and just, you know, huge schools of it. But I think each fish you eat is 70-year-old. Imagine you're there and you're, you know, it's okay if you eat a lamb, it's so many months old, but a 70-year-old fish is pretty rich to eat. Okay. The ocean's total 320 cubic miles of water and 440 million square miles of seafloor stretching over 7/10 of the planet. Their depths have been inhabited for a comparatively short time. For the present awesome challenge of life, the extreme cold as well as the crushing weight forbid easy adaptation. For the unprotected human body, 600 feet is the absolute limit. One atmosphere pressurized diving suit allow a man to go as deep as 2,500 feet. That's, you know, 700 meters. But for the often transparent creatures of the deep, the pressure inside their tissue is the same without, and there's not a problem. However, sperm whales endure the pressure close to 2,000 pounds per square foot as it dives more than 890 feet. I do believe it just completely collapses. It remains a mystery. I think they do know. The concentration at the lower depths is only a 1/13 that of close to the Earth, but within the zone of the lowest oxygen is a unique group of animals adapted to meet such challenges.
Oh, so I suppose you've got the oxygen dissolves and diffuses downwards, I suppose. Can't see why it would have a low concentration, because it's, I don't know, it would be mixing. The only thing I could see is that it's consumed, oxygen would diffuse, if you've got a glass of water with anything above it, it will automatically diffuse down. And so I think it must be just used up faster than it's pulled in. Obviously it's not being created there, so it must, can only, oxygen can only get in there from diffusion and then it's eaten up. I suppose that must be the story. Darkness might seem yet another obstacle, but the creatures of the deep have an answer too. While at 1,500 feet, the unaided human eye can only see coarse pattern of silhouettes and shadows, fish can discern subtlest differences, so sensitivity may regulate their depth. With changes in light level controlling morning and evening migration of various fish and krill, even eyeless creatures may register the sun's presence. Water molecules polarize the sunlight, which helps many animals in their hunting, as the tissue of their prey absorbs or takes the light passing through them. Squids employing special cells embedded in the skin use polarized light, which would appear indistinguishable black to the human eyes, to regulate their vertical migration and to signal to one another. Okay. So, polarization, is light is a vector problem, a process. It's just my issue is, does water polarize light? That's something I haven't heard of. I know that, so like, quartz that can rotate the polarization, because I don't quite understand how that works. There were not enough, where there's not enough life, many creatures create their own. Between 600 and 700 species have this facility, but they employ it conservatively, as every time they create light, they expose themselves. However, some creatures can vary the wavelengths they emit, thereby using the life itself as a camouflage. Several have modified cells that act like torches, to be turned on and off at will, presumably to find or pursue prey, while others have rows of lights on their bodies, or at the end of their legs, or tentacles. Another effective misdirection. Some fish have light-producing organs on their undersides, whose weak downward glow erases the shadow cast when they are viewed from below against the tentatively better-lit waters above. Others use bioluminescence as booby traps, coating an advancing predator with sticky, glowing tissue that makes the attacker vulnerable to usually clued hunters. Like Brenner is marked with exposing dye packets hidden in stolen currency, as one marine biologist colourfully puts it. Some eyeless creatures light up brightly when touched. Others concentrate red body pigment, which absorbs whatever blue-green light falls on them and reflects nothing, an effective visual stealth strategy. The predatory Molluscinus niger, known as the lightless loose jaw, generates long wavelength infrared in addition to blue luminescence, invisible to other deep sea animals, giving his vision in the same light zone as military sniper scope. The fish optics retinas contain derivatives of chlorophyll harvested from its diet of tiny crustaceans, which is modified forms allows it to generate infrared. My God. During the Cold War, US military considered using these creatures as sentries to signal the passing of Soviet submarines. In the end, however, Operation Lightness Loose Jaw never materialized. Well, this is something I didn't know about. Infrared visibility is impossible. Transparent animals, the better to conceal themselves from predators, have developed the smallest guts possible, as the intestines are only a visible part of their anatomy. In some, the stomach is a needle shape and always points down, whichever way the animal is oriented, minimizing the presence against surface light. Others cloak the stomach with reflective tissue,
which in the open oceans reflect lights that is indistinguishable from that behind it. All these highly varied creatures, be they fish, crustacean, algae, or other organisms, happen to inhabit deep ocean well away from the sun's glare. I don't understand how algae can inhabit the deep ocean. Yet, yet even the minutest microorganism living on or near the seafloor owe something to the existence of the sun. Swimming through H2O along the darkest frontier in the solar, of the solar realm, they rely indirectly on the oxygen released from the photosynthesis activated above the surface. That's right, the oxygen has to diffuse downwards if they're an oxygen-based organism. And so, and the thing is that if you breathe, it's almost an asphyxiation. There's a footnote. The sun, however, primarily energizes organisms living in the shallow, not the depths. Among the functions that certain coral and algae perform to manufacture a chemical, they act like a high-factor sunscreen, shielding both themselves and their polyps hosts from ultraviolet rays. Alginates from brown seaweed offer considerable protection from radiation, since they secrete iodine compounds which help treat cancer of humans. Japan is one of the world's lowest rates of breast, endothermal, ovarian, and cancer attributed to the help of goji, which concentrates eufalcladium, which interferes with tumor cells colonization, causing the disease cells to self-destruct. In protecting itself from the sun, seaweed has provided us with a new way to safeguard ourselves. Well, I think if there was a shred of clinical evidence, we'd know all about it. We'd be all over it. If seaweed, you know, if sushi saved you from cancer, I think sushi kitchens would be telling you that. That's my thing. The ocean, writes Robert Kunzig in his magic rule, Mapping the Deep, is the ocean's primary distributor of heat. That's true. Sunlight causes water molecules to strain at their hydrogen bonds, making them vomit. Their hydrogen bonds, pushing and pulling their neighbours, and the heat is stored and those vibrations can be transported great distances. Well, it is true that water's got a huge heat capacity, and the heat capacity is, you know, basically the equal partition theory is that your heat capacity that is per your mass is the number of degrees of freedom. Now, the great thing is that the degree of freedom is like how much shake. So if you've got a loose car, and so if you've got a Formula One, you can rock it easily. To get a loose car to rock, and you know, it's all falling apart, you rock it, and it takes a lot more energy as it's rocking apart. Now, oxygen, water is falling apart because it's got that hydrogen bond. That is, the hydrogen is not actually bound to the water. You can't have a hydrogen saying, I like that oxygen, but I'm going to hydrogen bond with that one. No, it's not like that. The hydrogen is between the two oxygens, hydrogen bonding with both. There's not a chemical bond and a hydrogen bond. That's because the person drawing it, decided. It's actually two hydrogen bonds. It's one of the things that just really gets my goat up as a scientist. Okay. The ocean's liquid topography is constantly shifting, which leads us on to the mighty agents of the sun, currents, and the tides. I love this type of stuff. Currents, which operate at all sea levels, are two types, surface and deep water. Sometimes they flow simultaneously in different directions at different paths, which I think is the fundamental theme. How can they not do that? Okay, there are nine major ocean streams. One, the Gulf Stream, which originates in Florida and flows north along the east coast of the United States, crossing the North Atlantic to the Norwegian Sea. It's a huge impact on the long-term weather of any landmass, such as overall the climate of Norway and British Isles, for example, is about 18 degrees Fahrenheit warmer in winter than continental interiors of the same latitude. The Labrador Current, which cuts south from the Arctic Circle and travels along the Canadian coast, called in the Canadian Atlantic provinces, and by Journey's End, coastal New England, at time. Some of it runs off into the Gulf of St. Lawrence, but most of its chilling mass continues southwest. 3, 4, 5, and 6. The North Equatorial, South Equatorial countercurrent, 3 and 4, which travel east-west near the equator. Both are about 600 miles wide and reach roughly 4 to 10 degrees either side of the equator, but never touch it, because it's deflected by the counterparts of the South Equatorial countercurrent and the Equatorial countercurrent, 5 and 6. The Koshio current, which separates from North Equatorial Current and sweeps across Taiwan and Japan, then splits to form the eastern branch flowing nearly to the Hawaiian Islands, and north branch skirts around Asia to merge with the cold Osho Current and the North Pacific Current. The Californian Current and the West Coast is partially responsible for the relative coldness of the water there. The Doldrums, 9, that is centered high, slightly north of the equator, where the intensity of solar radiation makes the air especially humid. Lower air pressure by the heated atmosphere expanding outwards creates clouds, light, variable winds, thunderstorms, squalls, and other severe weather patterns. The doldrums are also characterized by long periods in which the winds disappear, becoming sailing vessels for days or weeks, thus giving the language to one of the few nautical phrases that has a non-nautical meaning. Now, I just have and the doldrums. In general, when you heat air up, you get higher pressure. So low pressure is due to cold systems. I don't know. The two main factors determine how currents form and reform. The sun's great heat from the Earth's rotation. A third and lesser factor being the gravitational pull of the sun and the moon. I think the current is the sun's heat evaporating water and making it salty, but let's see what the... By warming the air above the oceans, the sun creates a wind to drive the water along through friction. Oh, rubbish. That's complete rubbish. Surface currents take up the upper quarter mile of any ocean, about a tenth of a total hydrosphere. If the water cools or makes... or is made salty through evaporation, it becomes denser and sinks, setting off fresh currents. But you can make it, if you heat it, you do two things. You create a time bomb. You heat it, it's going to sink when it cools. So what's that? That's with the global conveyor, because you heat it in Florida and the hot current, it's heating, it's less dense. It will stay less dense until it cools, and then it will sink and pull itself up. Okay, let's read if they've got this totally at all correct. If cooler water is made saltier through evaporation, it becomes denser and sinks, setting off fresh currents, which in turn transport the heat from one location to another, both upwards and outward, further altering the temperature patterns. Achelius wrote of the, quote, multitudinous laughter of the waves, but the sun's power to drive the winds across the water can build ocean surges up to 100 feet through trough to crest, and at any given moment there are up to 10 such monsters churning through the oceans, not quite the light-hearted image conjured up by Achelius. Lying in front of such waves can be deep depression, known as a hole in the sea, which can fling any ship that it traps into a fatal roller coaster ride. And you should see, of course, obviously nowadays they have the anti-roll stuff and ship rolling. And so on top of very tall skyscrapers, like the tallest buildings in Melbourne, they have a ship stabilizer. They have a big... So you've got this huge tower which would sway, and they've got a mechanical machine at the top, which they switch on and stops it swaying. It's, you know, they stop it. It's got a feedback process. So you get up a very tall skyscraper, let's say up in Melbourne or something like that. You know, these are the very tall buildings. They've got a stabilizing ship stabilizers at the top. I don't know whether how this always operates. These rifts form regularly in regions swept by powerful currents. The Arcus of South Africa, the Kyushu of Japan, the Gulf Stream of eastern United States, which the last two flow through the Bermuda Triangle, that mythical devourer of ships and aircraft. I'll tell you what, the Southern Ocean has got big waves, so I have friends who are scientists who just say that you have not seen anything yet. And this is, you know, you've got 2 weeks of waves, not three-story building waves. The Southern Ocean is pretty amazing. Some oceans layers can be no more than a few inches thick, but each is distinguishable from its neighbour by sharp changes in temperature and saltiness, which together govern its movements up and down. Water nearer the equator, and thus more intensely heated by the sun, can be 4 degrees warmer than the surface than further down. The warm currents of the equator, in part because they are lighter than the currents of the north and south, sweep towards both poles. Okay, I'm going to have to stop here to put out the washing. Okay, oh God, some of the science here just makes me weep. Back again after a break. Sorry for the interruption. I was called off to go on walks and various other things. I'll continue reading this, The Dark Biosphere. The advantage of this is that I have rests as I'm going along, so I don't deteriorate. The Earth's rotation acts on ocean currents through what is called the Coriolis force. Okay, it's actually not a force. That's a rotating frame of reference. It is an inertial frame of reference. You are accelerating as you're accelerating. Named after the 19th century engineer and mathematician Gustav Gaspard Coriolis, 1792 to 1843, which reflects currents northeast in the northern hemisphere and south eastwards in the southern. Such movements are affected by friction with the Earth and only the sea floor. The Earth's eastward rotational velocity decreases by a maximum of 1,000 miles per hour at the equator to zero at the poles. Okay, well, that's the acceleration, centripetal acceleration. As it mitigates across progressively slower latitudes, it is still travelling more quickly than the waters through which it passes. And given the greater momentum, it has to move diagonally north or south eastward in direction of the planet's turning. Or, in effect, you move up. Of a lower velocity, you move towards the equator, which is rotating at a faster velocity. And so, therefore, it looks to you, standing on the equator, that there's this force is not travelling as quickly coming up. It's an interesting thing. Beyond currents, there are monster waves. These too have a solar cause. Indirectly, in 1997, 80 people around the world watched satellite images showing winds change direction and a huge pool of unusually warm water roll across the tropical Pacific to mass into an area about 1.5 times the size of continental United States. This is the famous El Nino, now blamed for rearranging the weather patterns of the countries as far as Chile and Australia, and bringing storms, flooding, drought, and bushfires. El Nino means the little boy. In Spanish, it refers to baby Jesus. The effect usually reaches a peak around Christmas. Its twin sister is a rebound of unusually cool weather called La Nina, which shows up on satellite images as brilliant blue and purple stretching across the mid-Pacific. Either sibling can bring extreme hot weather or extreme cold, thus the ferocious winter chill of 1941-42 that inflicted the setback on the German invasion of the Soviet Union. When temperatures dropped to minus 40 degrees Fahrenheit, machinery froze and 250,000 troops died of cold and disease. Was set off later on? So, yeah, Hitler did actually have a bad roll of the die there. From these colossi's, it may seem literally to come down to talk about the tides, although those in the Minas Basin in Nova Scotia rise and fall by more than 50 feet twice daily. And the total power of waves breaking around the world coastlines exceeds 2 trillion watts, enough to supply the daily electricity needs of 200 billion or 300 billion homes, more than hundreds of times as many as there are in the world. Now, what I was going to say is tides is really differential velocities. So you're in an orbit, in the center of the orbit, you're at the mean velocity, traveling, if you are pulled out and travelling at that mean velocity, you're travelling too fast for that orbit, so you get flung into space. And if you're close to the sun and you're travelling at the mean velocity, you're travelling too slow, so you fall into the sun. It's a differential velocity, or differential orbital position with the mean velocity. Many people see tides as the moon's profits alone, but as often as the case, the sun can't be ignored. Well, I think the sun is just almost as big as the moon. We're tired from the Germanic root time or season, and not for anything watery. It has two meanings. First, variation at sea level at any point of the coast, which depends on the shoreline topography and the currents near the shore. Second, the formation of the Earth's land and water caused by the pull of the moon and the sun. 391 times further from the Earth, but 30 million times greater mass than the moon, the sun exceeds a far greater pull by a factor of 178. Well, there you go. But the differential velocity, which is what's important, it's not the actual pull, it's a differential pull from one side to the other. However, because tides relate not only to the strength of gravitational, but its gradient, well, there you go. It's the moon that's responsible for 56% of the Earth's tidal energy, and sun for 44%. Still very significant. And that's what they're talking about. It's differential and gradient. He's hit that. When the sun and moon get close to the Earth as each can during the perigee, they exert the maximum pull, causing the highest possible tides. When the Earth is at its greatest distance, the apogee, the tidal ranges are smaller. A new moon, when the sun and moon Earth are in alignment, the sun and moon pull on the Earth is the same direction. Oh no. Oh, I don't know. It's zysergy. S-Y-Z-Y-G-Y. I love that word when I came across it. It just means that the Earth, Moon, and Sun are in a line. But I think he's got it wrong. Let's see. It says when the Sun, Moon, and Earth are in alignment, so the Moon can be further, or the Earth can be further. It's zysergy. The solar tide argument augmenting the lunar, heightening the height of tides, and lowering the low ones. Zysergy. S-Y-Z-Y-G-Y. I love it. Term. I had it. The tidal cycle is 24 hours, 15 minutes long, during which, that's the reason it is that cycle is because the Earth is rotating, obviously 24 hours, but then the Moon is falling behind so many minutes an hour, minutes a day. Depending on local conditions, however, some places have no observable tides, or high tide that does not peak when the moon is overhead, but lags behind it by several hours. One can appreciate the dilemma of Bertrand Lady in The Knight's Tale, when Chaucer has it, the sea disappears. She looks over the cliff to find they have done so. Fortunately for her, since she is happily married, her suitor proves chivalrous and does not hold her to her promise. Tides have a source of speculation for millennia, although the oldest surviving tide table for the river spanning the village of London Bridge dates only for the 12th century. Romans generally, having known only the equatorial flowing in the Mediterranean, had little experience of them. Caesar describes how his extraordinary forces twice paid a heavy price for the ignorance of invading England along the Dover coast. Greeks write about the motions of the sea, but not until Kepler in Astronomia Nova. It's really important, that gradient thing. Galileo Diogio in 1632, was there any concerted attempt to explain them? The first world document version was given by in 1687 by Newton, although Laplace's Mécanique Céleste is the major text for the 19th century. Thereafter, the clearest descriptions of the tides are by two remarkable scientists, William Thomson and George Darwin, who's actually the fifth child of child. Well, he says it's the fifth child of child. So it's actually a family thing. And Thomson, I don't know whether... Sir William Thomson is the Thomson effect, which I'm working on. And he's also known as Lord Kelvin. There you go. And they've got William Whewell. It's not Reverend Whewell. Wow, could not be. Okay. The third great writer on tides was William Whewell. 1794 to 1866, whose tideology, as it's called, charted the movement of the world's ocean, and the object of showing all those points where throughout the globe waters reach the high point at the same time. Whirlwell, a polymath who went on to become accredited at Master Trinity College, Cambridge, introduced the term, or it's him, it's Reverend Whirlwell. Because I didn't realise he worked on scientists. Term scientist, English in 1834, in an article, Quarterly Review, spurring the alternative savant, as assuming it was too French. No, I think he was writing a critique of some girl's essay, I think. So it was anonymous. He offered the word to denote the common enterprise of all those studied the natural world, even their disciples. Disciplines were becoming more specialised and less unified. No, there's a lot more history. I think he has really got that, but he did do it. I didn't know we were worth doing tides. Thomson was one of the most brilliant, great 19th century men of science. He lies next to Newton and Westminster Abbot, and in 1882 addressed the British Association on the Working Tides. If I were asked to tell you what I meant by tides, he began, I should feel it exceedingly difficult to answer the question. The truth is, the word tide is, as used for the sail at sea, means horizontal motion of the water. But when used by the landsman and the sail at port, it means the vertical motion. He judged the mariner's notion correct, because before there can be a rise and fall of water anywhere, there must be some sort of, in some other place. Water cannot pass from place to place without moving horizontally or nearly horizontally. Yeah, okay, that's right. Often what we see, quote, more properly wind waves than true tides, but there is another rise and fall caused by the direct sun's heat, which affects the atmospheric pressure. When the barrier is really high, the water is pushed down by a greater pressure of air. It swells upwards and then drops. This sun-affected pressure affects lands too, but because the continents are much more rigid than the ocean, the effect is much smaller. Even so, Thomson explained, whole tracts of the continents may rise and fall as much as 16 inches at high or low tide. Yeah, this is the moon pulling us up. So I didn't believe he did. And we do not realise this, as everything around us flies and falls together, like a lake, swimming pools, baths, cups of coffee, or indeed human stomach, will not show any signs of the rising and falling. But still, tides do funny things. For example, tidal friction is the length of the day is by 1.6 milliseconds per century. Well, it's not tidal friction, it's the moon. It's the moon, it's the tide. And tides, that's the tide. The energy of tides is the orbital motion of the sun and moon. That's where the tide energy comes from. And so it goes. Sir George Darwin, who's the fifth child of Early's education, had been at his father's side, and although he was called to the bar, it is likely he always would turn to science. In 1898, he published Tides and the Kindred Phenomena in the Solar System, a scientific bestseller that later contributed to the long entry of Tides for the 11th edition of the Encyclopedia Britannica. Thomson, or Lord Kelvin of Largs, no, the reason why he's called Lord Kelvin is that he said, oh, well, I'm going to be called, and he was a really interesting character up in Glasgow, and there's the Kelvin River, so that's why he called it, as he became the first science elevated to a peerage. Had treated the Earth as incompressible sphere, one that would not be drawn out of shape by the solar and lunar pullings, whereas Darwin saw our world as having a liquid core responsive to both the sun and the moon's power. Well, of course, it's not. It's a plasticine core, but, you know, I don't know. A pound coined in Edinburgh, he liked to point out, is slightly heavier than the same coin in London because it's slightly closer to the Earth's centre. He calculated that, well, there's a whole heap of things there. It's not travelling, it's the centripetal force. He calculated that the rate past the Earth must have been rotating much faster than the Moon, much closer. Darwin set out to apply Newton's principle of calculating the Sun's effect on other planets. The efficiency of solar tidal friction is very much greater in its action upon nearer planets than further ones, he concluded. Speaking of his own planets, he showed the Earth's high tides occur at local noon and midnight, and low tides at sunrise and sunset, roughly speaking. Although in calculating tidal behaviour, the irregular distribution of land and water and various depths in the ocean in various places produce irregularities in the oscillation of the sea of such capacity that the real solution of the problem altogether beyond the powers of analysis. An almost un-19th century admission. Well, there you go, in this footnote here. One should not get too excited by this enhancement, though. High tides change our height by a factor of 10 to the bar 16, a distance of 1,000 times smaller than the diameter of the atom. In comparison with space, astronauts grow taller by up to 3 inches as the skeleton is unrolled. This is completely stupid. Restrained by gravity. The vertebrae relax in relation to the spinal column, which soon returns to normal on Earth. Equally, earthquakes make us lose weight. And when the world is dilated by a giant shock, gravity on the Earth's surface decreases by 10 to the 15%, meaning a 5,000-pound person loses a really a millionth of an ounce. That really would do if they did actually had to play around with the equation. What I must admit I do hate is people write the equation and they don't play with it. Beyond the powers of analysis it may be, but sailors have not waited for finding science to have been navigating the seas for thousands of years as best they can. For thousands of years that meant learning how to best harness the sun. Oh, it's not going too far. That's the end. So thanks a lot for listening. I'll put this all together and get it out. Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.